long ago, perhaps in the fall, I dealt with Peter. I think particularly the fall of Peter when he denied Christ three times. And that gave me the idea about looking into Peter's character or personality more deeply. If you think about Peter and the way he's portrayed in the New Testament, it's probably not long before you come up with the idea that he had the personality of what we might call an impulsive person. Let me start off this lesson by observing that the Bible, like every good book, not only has a theme, that is, an idea that its writers intend to develop and advance, but it also has what in literature is called character development. Character in this instance referring to a person or figure in the Bible. And what this character development means is that the Bible unfolds gradually information which allows readers to understand the character and the personalities and the ways and the motivations of its figures. And why is that? Because the Bible intends for us to learn from these people so as to be able to identify what is proper moral character and thereby more effectively develop good character in ourselves. One of the most notable instances of character development in the Bible occurs in the case of the Apostle Peter, or Cephas. His original name was Simon. Jesus was the one who gave him the name Peter, which in Greek means rock. Its Aramaic equivalent is Cephas. So Peter and Cephas both mean rock, just in two different languages. Greek for Peter, and then Aramaic for Cephas. So Peter exhibits a pattern of behavior which portrays him as bold, presumptuous, impetuous, impatient, ambitious, brash, and rash. Now, we'll have to acknowledge that these traits are rooted in something virtuous. They can be productive of good in people's lives if those traits are properly developed and channeled and controlled. But they were not often that way in Peter. They got him often into trouble. So I think the word which best captures Peter's character flaw is impulsiveness. He was an impulsive person. Let me give you a couple of dictionary definitions. The word impulse, according to the dictionary, means a sudden wish or urge that prompts an unpremeditated act or feeling. Abrupt inclination. Let me draw your attention particularly to the word unpremeditated. In other words, impulses drive us to do things that we don't think through, that we don't meditate upon and contemplate deeply or for very long. And then the word impulsive means, according to the dictionary, inclined to act on impulse rather than thought. So think about the nature of an impulsive person then, according to those definitions. The impulsive person tends not to think things through for very long or very deeply. Instead, he's moved by his feelings, by his urges, by the immediate passions that he experiences. I think you get the idea really why impulsiveness is wrong, but let's think of a couple of reasons and think upon those two reasons more deeply as to why impulsiveness is wrong. First of all, it can lead a person into folly or foolishness. There are a couple of scriptures in Proverbs to this effect. First of all, in Proverbs 18, verse 13, it says, "He who gives an answer before he hears, it is folly and shame to him." And then likewise in chapter 20, verse 25, Proverbs, it says, "It is a snare for a man to say rashly, it is holy, and after the vows to make inquiry." It is fundamentally characteristic of impulsiveness or the impulsive person not to be thoughtful, not to be contemplative. Impulsiveness and carefulness are opposites. The impulsive person acts on his feelings rather than his reason. He does not calculate the cost before he makes a commitment. And the problem with that, of course, is that if we have made a commitment without asking ourselves what it's going to cost us to follow through on that commitment, then we will find ourselves in a difficult situation, not wanting to do and possibly not doing what we've committed ourselves to doing. The impulsive person does not think ahead, but lives for the moment. Again, a couple of passages in Proverbs emphasize this point. In Proverbs 10, verse 5, first of all, it says, "He who gathers in summer is a son who acts wisely, but he who sleeps in harvest is a son who acts shamefully." And then, of course, one of my favorite creatures in the Bible, the ant. This might be the only place in the scriptures where the ant is mentioned. But in Proverbs 6, verses 6 through 8, I like the ant for this reason. "Go to the ant, O sluggard, observe her ways and be wise, which having no chief officer or ruler, prepares her food in the summer and gathers her provision in the harvest." In other words, even the little ant has enough sense to look ahead from the times of plenty to the times when food won't be so plentiful, and to put food in storage against that time when food will not be plentiful. The ant is wise in that respect, a lot wiser than some people I have known. So we ought to be able to see easily that the person who acts immediately on his feelings and urges, without giving due thought to what he's about to say or do, is eventually going to get himself and others into trouble. This is because, initially, what appears to be best is not necessarily the best thing to do or say. It might look good at first, but upon more careful analysis, we might come to realize, no, that's not so good after all. Have you ever second-guessed yourself? There have been times when I wish I had second-guessed myself. Appearances, as we say, can be deceiving. As Paul points out in 2 Corinthians 11, verses 13 through 15, even Satan disguises himself as an angel of light. So we can't go on what initially appears to be right. You know, the more serious something is, the more time we need to take to think about it. You know, there are some things in life that are not so serious. If it turns out to be a mistake, it's not a big deal. But there are some things that are very serious. We need to take time, all the time we need, to think about those things seriously. So, impulsiveness is wrong, first of all, because it can lead a person into folly. But secondly, getting more to the root of the problem, impulsiveness is wrong because, to be quite frank, it represents arrogance or conceit, pride on our part. If we are guilty of impulsiveness, the impulsive person thinks he knows more than he really does. He has too much confidence in himself. He thinks that he is smart, and he does not need, therefore, to take the time that others might need to take to look at a matter. He already knows what to do almost right away, and that's because he thinks he's smarter than other people. Oh, they need to take the time to think about it. But listen, I'm an intelligent person. I don't need to take as much time. So in Romans 12, verse 3, Paul, by the Holy Spirit, gives this warning. "For through the grace given to me, I say to every man among you not to think more highly of himself than he ought to think, but to think so as to have sound judgment, as God has allotted to each a measure of faith." Oddly enough, in our family, between my wife and myself, that is, she's the one who likes to do woodworking. I don't care about it. But I have learned this little proverb from her: measure twice, cut once. Measure twice, cut once. The idea is, if you cut a plank of wood too short for what you need it for, well, you're probably not going to be able to put it back together, glue it together again, or whatever. So you've wasted a piece of wood, perhaps a valuable piece of wood. So what you do before you make that one cut, the only cut you're going to be able to make, is you go back and measure again. In other words, be careful. A couple of other cliches or proverbs come to my mind. Haste makes waste. Okay, let's get into Peter then and see how he exemplifies impulsiveness. This is, by the way, one of the reasons, one of the many reasons why I believe that the Bible is inspired. Because of the way it carefully, sometimes even subtly, develops its characters. You wouldn't think, well, when you think of Peter, do you think of him as an impulsive person? The more you get to know Peter, the more you might be inclined to think that he is impulsive. But when you really get in more deeply, as I hope we'll do in this lesson, then you see that that was a problem with Peter. My wife told me a few weeks ago when I was thinking along these lines, you sure have been hard on Peter lately. Well, that's true. You know, I'm going to have to do some attitude adjustment with respect to Peter, maybe, because I tell you, I haven't found myself liking Peter a whole lot, especially before, you know, the day of Pentecost in Acts, the second chapter. During the ministry of Christ, there is a lot that he does that just does not make him attractive to me. Let me put it that way. Okay, what is that? Or what are those things? Let's look at instances of Peter's impulsiveness. First of all, in Luke 5, Peter had the temerity to correct Jesus' idea that he should attempt to catch fish after he had fished all night, he says, and had caught nothing. So he seems to be saying to Jesus, you know, listen, I'm the fisherman here. I know my job. You don't know, need to tell me what to do. I mean, listen, we've fished all night and haven't been able to catch anything. And you're telling me now to launch out into the deep and put down our nets again? And he knew who Jesus was. He had already become Jesus' disciple in John 1:40-42, and also in the latter part of Matthew 4, it's indicated he had already called Peter and the other disciples. Jesus issued multiple calls to Peter. At first, Peter would go back and forth between Jesus and his fishing business. So here, Peter is being called perhaps for a third time by Jesus. And Jesus really seems, as we would say today, really seems to mean business. But notice how he responds to Jesus, what Jesus tells him to do in verse 5. Master, that, by the way, the word master also indicates that he was already familiar with Jesus. Master, we have worked hard all night and caught nothing. But at your bidding, I will let down the nets. He sounds a little bit condescending to me when he says, oh, we haven't caught anything. We've worked, even though we've worked all night. But, sigh, if that's really what you want us to do, okay, we'll do it to satisfy you then. And, of course, they caught a big haul of fishes. And then in Mark, the first chapter, verses 35 through 38, we see that Jesus had gotten up early in the morning while it was still dark and had gone out to find an isolated place for prayer. Well, Peter doesn't seem to be too happy about that. Actually, he's called by his name Simon in verse 36. Mark 1:36, and Simon and his companions hunted for him and they found him and said to him, everyone is looking for you. Sounds like a rebuke to me. And by the way, that's what we'll find out about Peter. Peter is not above rebuking Jesus. Where have you been? Sounds like a mother to her child who's been away for a while. Where have you been? We've been looking for you. You shouldn't have left. So he seems to rebuke Jesus there for disappearing. Moving on, and I'm not going to read all of these scriptures, but it's interesting to me to note. I think this is pretty important to understanding Peter. It seems like he's always got to be the one to speak up first. In any situation, it's like he's the self-appointed spokesman for the apostolic band. He's got to be the one to explain things. He's got to be the one to ask the questions. He knows, if there are any questions to be asked, he knows which ones to ask. So perhaps he fancies himself the leader of the apostles. In the first of several characteristic instances of overestimating himself, Peter asked in Matthew, the 14th chapter, if he could walk to Jesus on water. Remember the storm and the wind and the waves? On that occasion, this is when Jesus came to them walking on water. And sure enough, it's Peter who says, Lord, may I walk to you on the water? And Jesus grants him permission to do so. Now, at first, everything went well. That's the way it is with Peter. In the beginning, things might be going pretty well. But then he doesn't follow through. He doesn't follow through on his commitment. He looked around, he saw the wind and the waves, he became frightened, and what happened? He began to sink, and Jesus had to reach out and save him. But that's Peter for you. He's always got what he thinks is a great idea, but he doesn't think it through. He has not prepared himself to follow through on what he has started or committed himself to do. Now, this may be just about the worst situation in which Peter displays his impulsiveness. He actually rebukes Christ on one occasion. This is in Matthew, the 16th chapter. Now, before I look at those verses with you, I think it's worth observing that Peter might have been emboldened to rebuke Christ on this occasion because he had just confessed Christ as the Son of the Living God back in verse 16. So he's praised or commended for that. He's even told that he's going to get the keys of the kingdom. So perhaps he's thinking pretty highly of himself. So when we get to verses 21 and following, this is what we see. From that time, Jesus Christ began to show his disciples that he must go to Jerusalem and suffer many things from the elders and chief priests and scribes and be killed and be raised up on the third day. And Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him, saying, God forbid it, Lord. This shall never happen to you. Now imagine the audaciousness of that. He's just confessed Jesus as the Christ, the Son of the Living God, and then he has the temerity to take him aside as if he were a child to reprimand him, and that's what he did. He reprimanded Jesus. And he said, no, you got it wrong. This shall never happen to you. And by the way, don't be talking like this around those others. Jesus rebukes him, and very sternly. As a matter of fact, there's a contrast here that Christ sets up between him and Peter. Terms used to identify that. Back in verse 16 of this chapter, Peter had just identified Christ as the Christ, the Son of the Living God. Now, how does Jesus identify Peter? He says in verse 23, get behind me, Satan. You are a stumbling block to me, for you are not setting your mind on God's interest, but man's. Let's move on to the next example. And let's look at Mark's account of Christ's transfiguration in Mark, the 9th chapter. When you read this, and read the part Peter plays here. And he and James and John have been taken up on a mountain. They see Christ transfigured. But as you read what Peter does, you think, isn't that just like Peter? So Mark 9, at the beginning of the chapter, or at least beginning with verse 2, we see that Jesus is transfigured and Elijah and Moses appear to him. And it says, beginning in verse 5, and Peter answered and said to Jesus, Rabbi, it is good for us to be here. And let us make three tabernacles, one for you and one for Moses and one for Elijah. Now notice verse 6 especially. For he did not know what to answer, for they became terrified. You know, I learned a long time ago that if you don't know what to say, it's probably best just to keep your mouth closed and not say anything. Because if you don't know what to say, there's a high risk that you will say the wrong thing. But Peter's idea seems to be, well, this is a very momentous occasion here, obviously so. Somebody ought to say something. Somebody ought to do something. And I guess it's up to me to do it and say it. That seems to be his attitude. He doesn't really know what to say or do. Scripture tells us that. But he seems to have this attitude that saying something is better than saying nothing. So he makes this proposal of building a tabernacle each for Jesus and Moses and Elijah. And he essentially gets rebuked by God from heaven for that. Why? Because he's putting Moses and Elijah on a par with Christ. But we move on. In Matthew, the 17th chapter, someone came to him toward the end of Matthew 17, it says, and asked him, does your teacher pay the 2 drachma tax? Now, this was a tax that was supposed to be paid to support the temple. Notice in verse 25, it says, and he said, yes. And when he came into the house, Jesus spoke to him and basically told him, well, actually, in so many words, Jesus tells him, no, I haven't paid the temple tax. And not only that, but in my status as the Son of God, I don't have to. But go back to Peter. Think about this for just a moment. He's kind of put on the spot. Does your teacher, and by the way, he's probably already recognized as the spokesman of the apostolic band, maybe even as the representative for Jesus here. So he's the one who is approached and asked, does your teacher pay the 2 drachma tax? And he really shouldn't be saying this, but he says yes. He doesn't want to look bad. He doesn't want Jesus to look bad. So it appears to me that he speaks out, at least out of ignorance, and possibly just tells a lie here. In any event, when he goes back into the house, Jesus corrects him. No, I haven't paid the tax, even though you've said I have, in effect. Move on into the next chapter, Matthew, the 18th chapter. Jesus had raised the matter of forgiveness, the possibility of forgiving an offender. So guess who has to ask a question about that? Get things clarified here now. So it says in verse 21, then Peter came and said to him, Lord, how often shall my brother sin against me and I forgive him? Up to 7 times? Now, he probably thought that he was being generous to offer to forgive a brother 7 times, but he only put himself with that answer into a position where Jesus had to correct him. No, not just 7 times, but to 70 times 7. Indeed, an unlimited number of times, basically. But it wouldn't have been so bad if Peter had stopped with his first question. If he had asked, Lord, how often shall my brother sin against me and I forgive him? I don't know that there would have been a problem at that point. But then he goes on to say, as if to suggest this to Jesus, it's a good idea, Lord, if we, you know, put the cap at 7 times. That sounds good to me. How about you? He had to go on and ask that question as if to say, you know, let's put a limit on it here. You know, I've got the right idea. I'm the one to say, you know, why don't we just put a ceiling of 7 times on it? And also what's interesting here, in his question, he does not seem to conceive of the possibility that he might need be the offender who needs to be forgiven. He doesn't seem to think about that. It's the other person who is the offender, and he's the one who needs to do the forgiving. That's the way Peter thinks about it. Remember I said the second problem with impulsiveness is that really the impulsive person is arrogant. Well, let's move on. Even into the next chapter, chapter 19, verse 27. It's important to note that in the context here, what had just happened was that the rich young ruler had approached Jesus and wanted to know what he should do to inherit eternal life. And he left Jesus when Jesus told him, you know, go and sell all your possessions. And he was a rich man, didn't want to do that. So he left. He was not agreeable to doing something that drastic. And Jesus went on to comment that those who are rich, are going to have a very difficult time, like the camel trying to get through the eye of the needle to get into heaven or into the kingdom of heaven. So this apparently prompts Peter to ask the question in verse 27. Lord, we have left everything and followed you. What then will there be for us? Now, let's think about this for just a moment. In the first place, he seems to be bragging on himself. This is an obvious self-commendation. We've left everything. What this rich young ruler was unwilling to do, we have done. We have left everything and followed you. And then it would have been so bad if he had just stopped there. Now, sometimes you want to tell Peter, stop while you're ahead. Be quiet now. You're okay. You've stepped up to the line, but don't take another step. No, Peter has to go ahead and say, what then will there be for us? And the word then means what he's asking is based upon what he had just said. And that is, we've left everything. So he seems to be looking for some sort of material reward as a result of the great sacrifices that they've made. So again, he shows that, you know, he's overextending himself in what he thinks of himself. Now we move over to the Gospel of John for other instances of Peter's impulsiveness. I find John 13 to be interesting in our study this morning. Jesus is going to wash his disciples' feet in John the 13th chapter toward the beginning, in order to impress his apostles with the need for humility. Peter's not exactly paragon of humility. It says, beginning in verse 5, then he, that is Jesus, poured water into the basin and began to wash the disciples' feet and wipe them with the towel with which he was girded. Verse 6, and so he came to Peter. Now let me stop there and just kind of set the stage a little bit. Peter was not the first one to get his feet washed. Jesus began with the other apostles. So at least some of the apostles had already gotten their feet washed. And guess what? They had not offered any objection to Jesus washing their feet. But then Peter's watching all of this. Jesus washing the other apostles' feet. And you can imagine he's thinking. But he's thinking the wrong thoughts. Because when Jesus comes to him, well, let's read on and see what he says. Lord, do you wash my feet? Jesus answered and said to him, what I do, you do not realize now, but you shall understand hereafter. Now, anybody else with the proper attitude then would have said, okay, Jesus knows what he's doing. He knows this is appropriate. I may think it's inappropriate for our master to be washing our feet, but Jesus has clearly indicated here that he's doing something that I may not, that I won't understand now, but I'll understand later. So I'm going to let it happen. Not Peter. Verse 8. Peter said to him, never shall you wash my feet. Notice how emphatic that is. Never. You know, there's the old expression too, never say never. Apparently Peter didn't hear that cliche. Eventually he does. Shortly hereafter he does get his feet washed. So he should have said, never shall you wash my feet. But what bothers me so much about this is that even though Jesus has just gently told Peter, in effect, let me do it. I know you don't understand, but I'm your teacher. Let me do it. I've got a good reason for doing it. You don't understand that now, but you will later. Most of us would have had the humility, well, in the first place, not even to have asked Jesus the question, not even have balked about it. But after he had answered us, as he answered Peter, at least let him go ahead and do it. He's the teacher. Not Peter, though. Instead, Peter comes right back and basically refuses to let Jesus wash his feet. Really, think about it. Isn't that kind of self-righteous on Peter's part? It's like him saying, in effect, Lord, I know better than you do. This is inappropriate. It's like, you know, he knows better than Jesus does. It sounds pretty self-righteous to me. Well, after Christ gave him a second, much sterner warning, he says in verse 8, if I do not wash you, you have no part with me. Then Peter backed off and he submitted. Peter's not completely finished yet. Okay, he's made a mistake, but instead of simply recognizing that with the appropriate humble penitent words. Instead, he has to go out making himself look as big as possible. So notice what he says. Lord, not my feet only, but also my hands and my head. Okay. Oh, you really do want to wash my feet then? Well, let's go all the way. Because see, I'm really submissive to you, Lord. I'll let you wash not only my feet, but my hands and my head also, if that's really what you want. Let's press on. Well, back to Matthew. Matthew 26, verses 33 through 35. This is where he avowed undying loyalty to Christ. Now, most people would kind of back off after hearing what Jesus had to say. In verse 33 of Matthew 26, beginning, we read, actually, the context does start in verse 31. Jesus said, they, the sheep, would all be scattered that night. Peter doesn't accept that. Notice how again and again and again, all the way up to the eve of Jesus' death, Peter is always seems to be telling Christ, I know better what ought to be. You may be the master, but I know more than you do. So let me tell you the way it's got to be. Verse 33, but Peter answered and said to him, even though all may fall away because of you, I will never fall away. He's really putting down the others there, isn't he? Everybody else might fall away, but not Peter. So Jesus has to come back and set him straight again. Truly I say to you that this very night before cock crows, you shall deny me three times. And does Peter back off then? No, not even then. He says, even if I have to die with you, I will never deny you. Now think about the, as we would say, chutzpah. He's got a lot of chutzpah. Imagine that. Jesus says, you're going to deny me three times tonight before the cock crows. And Peter, in essence, tells him, you don't know what you're talking about. But moving on, despite Christ's warnings and Peter's display of his lack of courage by fleeing the scene of Christ's arrest, he doesn't have enough sense, it seems to me, to say, you know what, I need to cut my losses. Okay, I'm not going to expose myself to danger or to a situation that I have not shown I've been able to cope with, so I'm going to stay away. Nope, not Peter. Verse 58 of Matthew 26 says, but Peter was also following him at a distance, as far as the courtyard of the high priest, and entered in and sat down with the officers to see the outcome. I believe it's John 18, verses 15 through 18, which actually says he went to the fire to warm himself. He was sitting among the accusers, sitting among the officers of the high priest in the courtyard of the building where Jesus was being tried. Now, he's not showing himself to be a very courageous person, but what does he do? He follows Jesus at a distance, comes up to the gate, I think John indicates in John 18, but doesn't go into the courtyard. And then apparently John, this apostle is not named, it is thought to be John, though, goes out and gets Peter and brings him in. Peter doesn't just step right inside the gate. Apparently, he goes to the fire to warm himself. Well, fire? Well, you got fire, you got light. So he was identified. He was identified in the light of the fire. And that gave occasion for him to deny Christ. Let me move on here to the next point. When the arresting party came, he tried to defend Christ. If you're a Bible reader, I hope you are, you're very familiar with this story. Now, of course, this was foolhardy. For the apostles would surely have died in the effort to defend Christ. I say that because John tells us in John 18, verses 3 and 12, that the Romans took Jesus' arrest very seriously. You might wonder, why did they send out so many? They sent out a Roman cohort. Now, a Roman cohort consisted of as many as 600 soldiers. So there were probably at least hundreds. Now, you might wonder, why did the Romans send out that many soldiers to arrest Jesus? Well, he had around him, for one thing. And also, it was night. So they weren't taking any chances, so to speak. They sent out this large cadre of soldiers to arrest Jesus. And even, this is interesting, In John 18, verse 12, it says, leading them was the top Roman military commander there in Jerusalem. This was probably the most powerful Roman in Jerusalem. So he wasn't leaving anything to chance. He was going to lead the troops himself. By the way, this is not just a centurion. This is what is called in the Greek a kiliarch. The word kiliarch means literally commander of 1,000. He was probably in his rank someone who was about at the level today of a colonel, if not a general. So he was leading these troops in the arrest of Jesus. Now, in Luke 22, verse 49, the disciples are represented as asking, Lord, shall we strike with the sword? When they saw what was going to happen, for a moment there, they had a surge of courage. And they said, Lord, shall we strike with the sword? Well, guess what? Peter doesn't wait for the answer from Jesus. He goes ahead and pulls out his sword and lashes out at a fellow by the name of Malchus, who was the servant or slave of the high priest, the very one who was going to be trying Jesus, by the way. So he had to be stopped with a strong rebuke by Christ. Now, this rebuke comes in various forms in Matthew and Luke and John's accounts. Jesus spoke to Peter and said, stop, no more of this. And Christ indicates in John 18, verses 4 through 9, that if he had not intervened, the apostles would have been perhaps slaughtered. Here's something interesting also. And we're coming down to the end. I think I have a couple more examples, this one and another one. Though John outran Peter to Jesus' tomb on the resurrection morning, we read this in the early part of John 20. The apostles are informed that Jesus' tomb is empty. So Peter and John take off running. And John, maybe he's the younger guy, I don't know. But he outruns Peter and gets to the tomb ahead of Peter. But one thing about John is that he's a bit more cautious. We're told that he gets to the tomb. Let me get over here to John, the 20th chapter. And he's hesitant to go in. He's cautious. So he just looks into the tomb. It says in verse 4 beginning in John 20, and the two were running together, and the other disciple ran ahead faster than Peter and came to the tomb first. And stooping and looking in, he saw the linen wrappings lying there, but he did not go in. Apparently, he realizes something of the gravity or the seriousness of the situation. The tomb of Christ is empty. Maybe I ought not step in here just right now. Going on, we read in verse 6, Simon Peter, therefore, also came following him and entered the tomb. Not Peter. He's not going to stop. He's going to barge right in there like a bull in the china closet, so to speak. He goes on in. John goes in after him, and it says, and he saw and believed at the end of verse 8. Last example. Let's go to John 21, the next chapter here. It was characteristic of Peter's vacillating nature that he seemed to have decided to return to his fishing business, or at least return to fishing at some level, after Jesus' resurrection. So we read at the beginning of John chapter 21 that he's there on the shore of the Sea of Galilee with some of the other apostles. And this sounds pretty impulsive to me. And verse 3 says, Simon Peter said to them, I am going fishing. They said to him, we will also come with you. So he leads them into fishing there. And this passage is similar to what we read in Luke 5, something that occurred years earlier. I think it's interesting to compare John 21 and Luke 5 then. So Jesus arrives on the seashore here, but he's not immediately recognized. They're about 100 yards off the shore fishing, it says in verse 8. They had fished, but they had not been able to catch anything. It says in verse 7, that disciple, again we think this is John, that disciple therefore whom Jesus loved said to Peter, it is the Lord. Now notice what Peter, this is a very, can we say, Peter-esque thing for Peter to do. Peter doesn't say, grab your oars, men, let's row back in the shore. Christ is there. No, what does Peter do? And so when Simon Peter heard that it was the Lord, he put on his outer garment, for he was stripped for work, and threw himself into the sea. But the other disciples, verse 8 says, came in the little boat, for they were not far from land. So this is Peter. You would think any sensible person, okay, it's Christ. Okay, let's take the boat back in. Not Peter, impulsive Peter. He takes a plunge. He puts on his clothes and then takes a plunge right into the water and swims to shore ahead of the boat to get to Jesus. You know, there's something endearing about that, I'll grant you. But at the same time, it's interesting to me that he swims to shore like that. And then at the end of the chapter, of course, Jesus had to tell Peter again. Now remember, he had told him in Luke 5, years earlier, now you're going to be fishing for men. Peter seems to have forgotten that. Maybe he thinks the whole plan has been changed with Jesus' death and resurrection. So he's going back fishing. Jesus has to remind Peter again, listen, your fishing days are over. You're not a fisherman anymore. That's when he asked Peter three times until Peter gets kind of irritated with him or frustrated with him, it seems like. He asked him three times, do you love me more than these? In other words, the fish and so forth. Because now you're going to be tending or shepherding my flock. Not going to be a fisherman anymore, a physical fisherman. You're going to be a spiritual shepherd. In conclusion, we can see that Simon, Peter, as he's presented in the New Testament, is a man of passions, and he follows those passions, perhaps too readily or without enough forethought. And yet, not everything about impulsiveness is bad. It can also represent eagerness, initiative, zeal and alacrity, or readiness to work. And that was Peter. If something needed to be done, Peter was right there on the spot to do it. He was an eager person. And so there was something basically good in Peter. It's just that needed to be molded and shaped by Christ. He was training his disciples and teaching them. And Peter eventually became, of course, a great leader in the kingdom of heaven. Along those lines, it's interesting. I just mentioned Peter's readiness to act in John 21 verse 10. When Jesus said, bring some of the fish which you have now caught. Peter was the one who jumped up immediately, apparently, and went to do it. You don't have to tell him anything twice. He's ready to act. So it says, Peter went up and drew the net to land full of large fish, 153. I almost get the idea that Peter does this all by himself. He grabs the end of the net, which was apparently lying on the shore, but the fish are still in this large net. It's the same net, evidently, floating out there or out there in the water. And he takes that and pulls it. Almost makes me think it was miraculous. I don't know if he was getting any other assistance or not, but he's the one who acts. Like I said, you don't have to tell Peter twice. He's got that spirit of initiative. I have been hard on Peter, granted, in this lesson. But sometimes when bad things come out in Peter, it's because at bottom, there's something good there. It just needs to be shaped and molded properly. And if that is done, then those people can really do a lot of good. This says something, of course, for Jesus. Jesus recognized the good leadership qualities in Peter. He honed them so that they might be used to proper and optimal effect for the purposes of the advancement of the kingdom of God. And to this end, Jesus directed his attention and words to Peter. He's often seen speaking to Peter. He recognizes something in Peter, and he recognizes that it can be put to good use if he can just get through to Peter and get him to understand some things. And apparently, he eventually succeeds. So it's a tribute to Christ's love and patience that he saw potentiality in Peter, and he worked with Peter to develop that potential in him. After all, there must have been a good reason why Jesus gave him the name Peter. which means rock. Thank you.